Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee. Clerk, would you take the roll, please?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Representative Eastland?
Here.
Anderson?
Here.
Blaine? Ellison? Fuller?
Here.
Hillstrom? Hilty? Johnson? Lesch? Lippman? Meslow? Murphy? Paymar? Powell?
Here.
Rhodes? Soderstrom? Strand?
Here.
Tao?
Okay.
Walls?
Okay, we'll hold the minutes until we achieve a quorum, but we'll proceed into the bills this morning.
The first bill on the agenda is House File 2339, Representative Smith's bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. How are you, sir?
Very good. Very good. Want to move your bill?
I will. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2339 and be recommended to pass.
Okay, the House File 2339 is before us, and why don't you proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill relates to correctional officer safety and addresses the process by which collection of blood samples from an inmate can occur when a corrections employee is significantly exposed to the potential transfer of a bloodborne pathogen. I have with me Mr. Johnson today, who's going to be more explicit on the reasons for the bill, but let me just try to walk you through and explain as to what it does. Under current law, a blood sample can be taken from a prison or a jail inmate to test for bloodborne pathogens if a corrections employee is subjected to a, quote, significant exposure. An inmate must either consent or there must be a court order sought in order to draw it and test it. The bill would establish procedures that could be followed if there were no consent of the inmate. This bill would essentially establish a procedure for a timely determination of a course of treatment that would reflect accurately the needs of the safety of the corrections employee. At this time, I'd like to ask Mr. Johnson, if you will, to explain the needs, the reason, and why this would be a good idea, and then I'll stand for questions.
Johnson, would you state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Robert Johnson. I'm here on behalf of Teamsters Local 320, in which we represent most of the state's local correctional facilities, often referred to as county jails. This bill, however, reaches beyond just the county level. It also includes state correctional officers who work in the state's prison system. It is somewhat of a indicator of our current society that we have to come before this committee with this kind of a bill. However, working in jail facilities has become more and more of a volatile environment in which our correctional officers are exposed to a number of different hazards and dangerous scenarios. One of the scenarios that has occurred in recent years is that inmates will fight with our correctional officers. They will bite them. They will throw feces at them. They will spit upon them. They'll do any number of things when they're being confronted. A part of those situations involve the transfer of blood or blood pathogens. Under the current situation, we do have, if the proper documentation is filed and we get it to the courts, we can require a blood draw from the inmate. However, on the local level, it may take up to 5 or 6 months. Now, let me tell you what the jailer must go through during that 5 or 6 month period. He reports to work this afternoon. There's an altercation. There is blood transferred between the inmate and the jailer. The inmate refuses to have a blood draw. As a consequence, several things have to be put into motion. First of all, we have to get our jailer to a physician in which they will mix up what we call a pharmaceutical cocktail, a cocktail that is hopefully going to prevent the transmission of hepatitis C, AIDS, and other blood pathogen diseases. Psychologically, this officer is going through a lot of anguish as a result of not knowing, and maybe not knowing for 5 or 6 months. In the meantime, as he takes this pharmaceutical cocktail, he becomes very ill because the drugs that he's taking into his system can be compared to chemotherapy for cancer patients. So we have jailers who are out of work on workers' compensation as a result of taking these pharmaceutical drugs and waiting for the court to finally order to find out if, in fact, they were even needed to begin with. This bill would take and place into law that the inmate would be required to have a blood draw immediately so we could find out if there were hepatitis or AIDS or other communicable diseases through the transfer of blood. We also placed in the bill protection so that once this blood draw is done, it cannot be used for any other purposes. Our intent is not to further place crimes upon the individual based on the result of the test, as much as this is a protection for our jailers. There is somebody here from the Department of Corrections. If you would want to hear from the state perspective, I bring the local correctional officers, and I would even ask maybe Representative Fuller from Beltrami County, who has a very large jail facility in his community, that this is an important issue, not only statewide, but it comes right down to many of you legislators on the local level. This is an important piece of legislation. You will be hearing other legislation in this committee in the next several days that deal with all kinds of issues regarding assaulting of police officers, throwing feces. I know Representative Johnson has a bill later on today. This is all a result of what's happening with our law enforcement and our correctional officers trying to do their duty. And I would sure hope that the members can see fit to support this piece of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any other testimony, Representative Smith?
Mr. Chair, no. I'm ready for questions.
Okay, before we have questions, we should take note. There's a group of students here today who are from Burnsville High School seniors here visiting the Capitol and trying to understand how things work, seated to our right here. So why don't we welcome you to the committee, and hopefully you won't have to be in any situation where you ever have to deal with any of the things that we're talking about in this committee. But welcome. Okay, are there any questions on the committee? Representative Lippman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Johnson, I understood you to say that that there would be no other purpose other than to, I guess, to do a health-related examination, but I'm looking at page 2 of the bill, lines 16 through 20, and it suggests that the warden at the facility, do you have the text in front of you? It suggests to me that the warden of the facility has broader discretion than just the health-related aspect, specifies the purposes for which the test may be used, limits access to the test results, for presumably the warden's construction of direct need, and establishes some protocol for later destruction after they are, quote, no longer needed, whatever those terms might mean. I'm just wondering whether, well, do I understand it correctly? It seems to be broader than the description that you provided, and whether I've got it right.
Representative Smith, or who wants to answer?
Well, looking at the language that you're referencing, um, line 16 through 20. Is that correct, Representative Whitman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, it is.
Okay, just a second. Oh, Mr. Chairman, Representative Whitman, the that language. References when the head of the correctional facility may order a blood sample and the reasons and what he or she may do with it. First of all, there has to be probable cause to believe that there was a significant exposure. That's the first hurdle to get over. The next includes then the safeguards against any unauthorized use or any unnecessary disclosure. I think the language is somewhat self-explanatory. The safeguards would include the purpose for which the test results may be used. Well, the purpose is to draw blood and see if the whatever was thrown at the correctional officer to see if it's tainted and if it requires treatment of the correctional officer so that his or her illness does not occur. It limits the access to those test results, and of course the chain of handling, I guess, would be the warden, the doctor, or anyone in between that's necessary for transporting the sample to and from the doctor for testing, and then back to wherever it's going to be safely kept, so that when the results are in and the item that was thrown at the correctional officer is not tainted, then the item will be destroyed or probably kept until the course of treatment is selected. Settled upon and delivered to the correctional officer, at which point, once they're no longer needed, they would be destroyed. So I think that's the lines that govern that and describe that.
Representative Lippman?
Mr. Chairman, Chairman Smith, Representative Johnson, I guess what I'm trying to understand is, let's say Warden Christ at Lionel Lakes has an incident like this. Does he have the discretion to describe for what uses that sample can be put to, or does your bill or some other law restrict that discretion? If he takes a sample, can he use it for a biometric file or some other purpose other than the health-related test on behalf of the officer? I guess that's kind of the first part of the question. And if he doesn't, is it this bill or some other law that restricts that discretion? I'm just trying to figure out the law here.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lippman. Let me begin by saying that Mr. Cox helped us certainly in this whole issue in regards to the draft. And one of the things that we had requested is to get right at the brunt of your question, that this blood pathogen or this blood test not be used and not be placed in a biomedical file, not to be used in any other way other than this is strictly a bill that, and if the language does not, by the way, if the language does not get at that, then I would certainly want to work with you or others to correct that. But again, the test should not be kept in somebody's file for future action. This is strictly for the correctional officer to find out if, in fact, this person has a transmittable disease. And so the intent is clearly that it not be used. Whether maybe Mr. Cox could help explain on page 2, lines 15 through 20.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lippman, I'm sorry that I did not hear your question. I was in a conversation with Representative Johnson. If you could restate it, maybe I'd be able to lend some.
We'll leave it to the chair. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cox, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is under House File 2339, how broad the discretion is for the warden to describe the uses for which a compulsory sample is put. And it may well be that there is some other law that I don't know about which restricts the discretion in some other area. But as I understand this bill, the warden would have fairly broad discretion to specify the purposes for which the test results may be used. If that's true, and I might not have any complaint about that, but I just want to know what issue I'm passing on when I'm voting.
Mr. Chairman, I now have with me Mary McComb from the Department of Corrections, and I believe she can address that.
Okay, would you state your name for the record and proceed.
I'm Mary McComb. I'm from Legal Services, the Department of Corrections. This bill, I believe, amends a packet of statutes, and the other statutes do address what the test results may be used for. There are other sections within 241, whichever this is, that restricts the use of the test results only to be provided to the exposed employee's treating physician. And I also believe that the test results need to be reported at least to the Department of Health under the statewide HIV reporting schedule. But those are the only two. The other statutes specifically prohibit use in a criminal proceeding or any other kind of use of these test results.
Representative Smith? Pardon me, Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, as this bill moves forward, I'm glad to vote for it, but would you be open to an amendment on the floor that references those other statutes instead of the language specifies for the purposes for which the test results may be used?
Representative Smith?
Absolutely, and my preference, of course, would be to see it, have it prior to standing up on the floor and starting to talk about this bill. Okay. So the answer is yes.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make clear in my mind that this does also cover follow-up tests on the same incident. For instance, frequently these happen, and there will be an initial test, but then there will be another one, an additional test 6 months down the road, just to make sure that whatever, if there was some sort of bloodborne pathogen that the first test missed, that the second test is a confirmation. I'm just want to make sure that we're not leaving that part out and wouldn't have to go get a court order to get the second one.
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paul, it would be my understanding that the same procedures would be in effect if, in fact, there was concern 6 months down the line. It would be in effect. And I would, Mr. Chair, for Representative Lippman, Chapter 241.33 and Chapter 241.342 are the procedural chapter of law regarding blood-borne pathogens.
Okay, any other questions from members of the committee? Anybody who wants to speak to the bill from the audience? If not, any more comments, Representative Smith?
Well, Mr. Chair, yes. In closing, I would just like to suggest that we already do and will continue as a state to take care of take due care and recognition of the legal rights of the people who are incarcerated in this state. That's proper, it's right, and it's required. We also need to recognize that we have correctional officers who work in these facilities who do the job for which they are paid, and that is to keep the inmates there and to help keep this society safe. They're working in a dangerous working environment. The inmates ought not to throw things at the correctional officers. They ought not to throw things that could be contaminated and cause illness or even death if not treated. The current treatment, the current law that we have for the treatment is designed for a worst case scenario. It does not permit this kind of immediate timely determination of the problem. The cost in dollars for the treatment in the worst case scenario can reach into the thousands. This, if you're interested in saving dollars, would amount to very few hundred in the processing of these items. We have a right not only to look after the rights of and duty to look after the rights of the inmate, but also the correctional officers. Therefore, I would renew my motion that House File 2339 be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Beamer.
Real quick question. Representative Smith, have any other states adopted similar statutes that you know of, and have there been any constitutional challenges to those statutes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beamer, off the top of my head, I can't answer that question. I will find out the answer. I don't know.
Thank you.
We've got an answer right here, Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, and Representative Paymar, I did do some research into that, and I was not able to find any other states that had a statute that was quite like this one. A lot of other states do have the testing procedure that Minnesota already has on the books, which involves a full-blown court procedure. Since no other states have one like this, there really weren't any cases on point, any other challenges that would be useful in determining how the courts would view this from a due process standpoint. So it is somewhat novel.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pimark.
Mr. Cox, then, is it possible that there would be grounds to challenge this on constitutional grounds, a violation of due process?
Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar, yes, there's always that chance. There's less due process here than a full-blown court hearing, so I wouldn't be surprised at all if at some point it was challenged. Its success is up in the air. I don't know if I'd say 50-50. There is a chance that it could be struck down. It's really not clear. There's not a lot of precedent out there right now that would help guide us in how the courts would look at it. It's certainly not. It's not clearly unconstitutional, and it's not clearly okay either.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, I guess I have two questions, and I'll state them both right now. One is: will there be anything written in the inmate's manual regarding the inmate's rights and responsibilities, notifying them that if a if genetic material or whatever is thrown on or put onto a guard, either however means, that they may be subject to a blood draw without benefit of a hearing? Will that be included in the DOC materials? Because I know the inmates do have handbooks that they have to sign or that they are issued based on the rules of the institution. And then the other one, is there anything that would limit and make certain that the blood sample is not used for any other purpose other than to detect exposure of a prison guard? For instance, is this going to be used to investigate whether somebody has been using contraband substances? Is this going to? So those two questions are my questions.
Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Johnson can answer.
Okay, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In response to the first one, we didn't include that both local and state facilities put this in their literature or whatever at the time that the person is incarcerated. Certainly we could put it into law, but the assumption is, on my discussions, is that it will be done. It would be a part of the information packet that they all receive, and they should receive. I mean, this shouldn't be popped on them after the fact. They should at least have some prior knowledge. The second is that we had a discussion on this, and in the blood pathogen law, Chapter 241.33 and 241.342 speak to the procedures already in law regarding the collection. It is the intent of this bill, and I will say it again, that it should not be used for any other purpose, not to check for drugs, not to check for anything other than it's simply a protection for our correctional workers, and that once the blood has been drawn and for check for blood pathogen diseases, it needs to be destroyed and the record sealed, and it should not be used for any other purpose.
Representative Johnson also had a question.
Marshal, a comment. I appreciate you, Representative Smith, bringing this bill forward, because I have observed firsthand some of these significant exposures to our correctional employees, and it's a tremendously stressful event, and the kind of process that's being recommended, I think, is sensible and responsible. So, thank you.
Okay, we have no other questions. So, at this point, Representative Smith renews his motion. House File 2339 will be recommended to pass and move to the general register on the House floor. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is passed. The next bill on the agenda is House File 2455. Before we start that, Representative Hilty, you've had a chance to look at the minutes.
I did, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Hilty moves the minutes as they are recorded. All those in favor of accepting those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the minutes are accepted. Representative Smith, House File 2455 is next on the agenda. Would you want to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I would move that House File 2455 be recommended to pass.
Okay, House File 2455 is before the committee. Why don't you begin your testimony, Representative Smith?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have Department of Corrections here with me. The legislation is fairly straightforward. It implements a change in the custody level classification for Minnesota prisons by eliminating the current level 6 designation and going to a 5-level classification structure. It's all right with the committee that Department of Corrections put a little more fuller explanation on that, and then we'll stand for questions.
Okay, would you state your name and for the record and proceed with testimony?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Scott. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Facility Services Division, Department of Corrections. This is simply an efficiency move that follows a practice that has changed with the Department of Corrections. Currently, Rush City is at a level 4. We intentionally did that. It's there alone, and we opened that facility to get some experience with it, and it was opened as a high-security double-bunk facility. We are now beginning to double-bunk at Stillwater and St. Cloud. We've had more experience with Rush City, and so we're requesting to merge Stillwater, St. Cloud, and Rush City into one security level. That would reduce us from a 6-level to a 5-level system. Oak Park Heights would still be alone at the top as our only maximum security facility. And this will also give us some cost savings as it will have less inmate transfers throughout the system as they move their way through from higher custody levels.
Representative Smith, any other comments?
Further,
questions from the committee? Questions? No questions? Representative Leck.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Scott, why did we have the 6-level system in the first place?
Okay. Mr. Scott.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the 6-level system was indicated in order to place what we thought were all the facilities at the appropriate level at that point in time. Given that the mission has changed slightly, that we've had more time with Rush City, by condensing it and losing one level, we think we're improving the system.
Any other questions, Representative Ellison?
Mr. Chair, is this bill intended to address concerns at Rush City specifically, Representative Smith or Mr. Scott?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, no, this is simply attempting to address what we believe is a correction in our system.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
What classification in terms of risk level will this elimination of level Will this address? Who's this going to affect?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, This will merge those offenders that are currently at level 4 and 5 into one level 4. It will not allow anyone to move to a lesser security prison or medium security any sooner than they would have already been able to.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
What will this actually do in terms of the way you run the prisons at this point?
Mr. Scott.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, currently we have inmates come in through St. Cloud. They're classified. They're placed at the appropriate level 1 through 6. When an inmate, let's say, is placed at level 6 at Oak Park Heights, he will naturally reduce with good behavior. He'll be eligible to move to St. Cloud or Stillwater. Then he'll move to Rush City, then he'll move to level 3, level 2 if he's eligible. This would allow us to have more discretion in placing inmates around the system at the level 4 between those three facilities, and would mean one less transfer. An inmate could go from Oak Park to Stillwater, wait until he is eligible for level 3, and then move directly to a medium custody facility. That's why we say it's cost savings and a more efficient system.
Any other questions from the audience? Representative Smith, any other comments?
No, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that Bill 2455 be recommended to pass.
Okay, Representative Smith has renewed his motion that House File 2455 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the bill is passed. Next on the agenda is House File 2651.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Smith,
I'd move at this time that House File 2651 be recommended to pass as well.
Okay, House File 2651 has been moved to pass. Mr. Smith, proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, this bill was brought to me as well by the Department of Corrections. It would amend the new Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision by providing certain procedures for retaking and reincarcerating of parolees and probationers. It also delays repeal of the old compact with a time in the bill itself. At this time, I'd also like to ask a representative from the Department of Corrections to offer a little more fuller explanation.
Okay, would you state your name for the record and proceed with testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ken Mers. I'm director with the Community Services Division of the Department of Corrections. Approximately 2 years ago, this body passed what we refer to as the new Interstate Compact. The Interstate Compact is the mechanism that's used with all 50 states and three districts for the transfer of supervision of offenders from one state to another. We had been operating under the old compact for many years, probably back in the 1930s when it was originally passed. So 2 years ago, there was an effort on a national level to pass the framework of a new compact, which was done 2 years ago by this body. At that time, we put in a sunset for the old compact that is due to expire July 1st of this year. The thought was at the time that all 50 states would pass a new compact and that we'd be ready to go with it. However, at this point in time, there are still three states and two districts that have not passed the new compact. So we still have to have a mechanism to deal with those states and the transfer of their offenders, either our offenders to them or their offenders to us. So we are asking just simply that we extend that sunset on the old compact for another 2 years to allow those three states the time to pass the new compact. At the same time, in the framework of the new compact, in the old compact, we had language that allowed us to issue warrants on offenders that were in our communities that we felt were a public safety risk, and it would permit us to pick these people up, put them into custody, and hold them until we can hold a probable cause hearing. Prior to waiting for the other state to authorize this. At the time, the national level, we were advised that this was not needed with the new compact. Since we passed the new compact, we've now been told by the federal the national level people that it would be a good idea to get that language back into the new compact as it was in the old. So we're just asking to add that section into the new compact. That will allow us to issue warrants and retake offenders.
Is anybody on committee have a question? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More of a comment. I've sat on the Interstate Compact Commission for the past year, and we've reviewed this matter. And it is good public policy, and I appreciate you bringing it forward. I think from an adult probation standpoint, it does provide for more effective supervision. So just a comment.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from the committee or anybody else in the room? If not, Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, I'd renew my motion that House File 2651 be recommended to pass.
Okay, Representative Smith renews his motion. House File 2651 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion bill passes. Next on our agenda, House File 2484. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, my motion would be that move that House File 2484 be recommended to pass.
Okay, House File 2484 is before us. Why don't you proceed with your testimony?
Very good. I hope there's someone here from, yes, the Department of Public Safety. Mr. Chairman, this is a bill that was brought to me by the Department of Public Safety. I don't like the word housekeeping bill, but I would suggest this may be one. It contains allegedly minor technical and policy changes relating to CRIMNET. I'm going to ask the representative of the DPS to offer a more full explanation. Then we'll stand for questions.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Would you state your name for the record and proceed with testimony?
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Dan Starkamp. I'm the IT manager for the Department of Corrections, and I'm representing CRIMNET here today and presenting the information on behalf of the DPS. I've had the privilege of chairing the subcommittee that actually looked at changes that they wanted to propose to CRIMNET and CRIMNET language, 299C65. I'm going to talk just quickly about the process and what our recommendations are. The process was we had a subcommittee of the task force made up of courts, corrections, law enforcement, as well as locals and DPS. And we came up with recommendations that we presented to the task force. The task force reviewed those recommendations and had us go back to the drawing board a few times. They made recommendations to the policy group, and the policy group then made some changes as well, and they passed what you see before you today as recommendations to the legislature. There's really six changes here, and they're all clarifying, deleting old, outdated sections or technical changes in the process. The first clarifies the CRIMNET project manager actually reports to the policy group. This is really the intent that the policy group had all along. I think the intent of the legislature was more of a clarification statement in the process. Secondly, it adds education and training to the CRIMNET project responsibilities, and this actually allows us to eliminate a couple old, outdated sections later on. Third, it cleans up language that separates the task force from the actual report. In the past, the two were actually combined, and it kind of got convoluted looking at the legislation. This clearly states who is on the task force now and what the responsibility is, as well as what the report is required to provide. Third, it eliminates the director from the Office of Strategic and Long-Range Planning from the task force. This was an organization that was eliminated in the last round of budget cuts, and that position is no longer on the task force. Again, it's a technical change. Fifth, it adds to the reporting basically what the status and review of the current efforts are, recommendations of the policy group and the task force, as well as what the summary of the activities are that's reported to the legislature on an annual basis, as well as the governor's office and the Supreme Court Justice. And finally, it repeals two old sections. Both of these had reports due in 1994. The first dealt with education programs. And again, we put that into the overall requirements of CRIMNET, as well as there is a criminal code renumbering required back in 1994, which is also being eliminated. Mr. Chair and members, that is the summary. Richard Pilmar, had a question.
Mr. Starkamp, will any of these changes assist in trying to remedy some of the questions that were raised by the legislative auditor's analysis of the failures of CRIMNET?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, the policy group is having a special meeting where they're going to be reviewing the recommendations of the OLA report, Office of Legislative Auditor's report on CRIMNET, and we'll be providing responses to each specific area that they're making recommendations to. The CRIMNET office had a shift in focus in the last 6 to 8 months that the auditor in the report has identified. And a lot of the issues that they've presented were issues that we've already been dealing with. But we're going to deal with each one that they've come up with and provide recommendations based on what the direction the policy group and the task force are going to go with that.
And, Mr. Chair, will the legislature get some kind of report back from the policy group?
Mr. Chair,
how you're going to rectify some of those problems?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, yes. The policy group is going to meet again on the 24th to finalize a response to the legislature and to the legislative auditor.
Any other questions of these testifiers from the committee? We do have someone from the audience that wishes to testify. Why don't you come up to the mic and
Mr. Chairman, for the
please
record.
State your name for the record and proceed with the testimony.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I have been a member of the Criminal Justice Information and Juvenile Task Force, which has been involved with CrimNet since its inception 11 years ago as one of the citizen members. And one of the things I wanted to say that I think this is a good bill. There are some issues, as you know, by the legislative auditor's report, and I'm glad that at least some of that discussion was brought up. There was, from the task force, which is made up of many people, they did recommend to the policy group that there be at least one member of this task force, a voting member on the task force of the policy group, because the task force does a lot of the legwork. A lot of state employees, government employees, volunteers, representatives like Steve Smith and Leo Foley, senators, have served on these committees, have devoted lots of time, your staff, and at least with some members of the task force felt at least there should be a voting task force member on the policy group. That was rejected at the policy group level. So that's an item that I share with you, but I want to let you know that a lot of good people, and they're all good people, are working hard to make sure CrimNet works. And the leadership at the House, through Representative Smith and other folks, are doing, and we're doing the best we can, and hopefully we'll get over some of the hurdles that the LAC does. And it's good for the state that we have an integrated criminal justice information system done with good policy, privacy, and but to make sure that law enforcement gets the information that they do truly need. Thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you. Representative Lippman.
I guess I would like, Mr. Chairman, leave to make a short oral amendment if I could, or this time or some other time.
We have nobody else on the list here, so this would be the time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Smith, or if I could turn members' attention to page 5, line 29. One of my concerns, Mr. Chairman, and members, has been with the history of CrimNet. I believe it was back in 2000 we tasked the CrimNet folks to do a risk assessment. It was over that report was a year, more than a year overdue, and before the I think it's the Eritrea group finally got around to assessing risk. I think under new management has now got the project back online. But I'm concerned that the language on lines 28 and 29, the status of review of current integration efforts, is not nearly specific enough. So I would propose to add on line 29, after the semicolon, a new 2. So a new paren 2. Number and description of project milestones achieved during the prior calendar year, semicolon, renumber the others accordingly. Because in my judgment, I think we need exactly to know what was accomplished in the prior year. I'm concerned that if it's left to just number one, status and review of current integration efforts, yes, we made some progress, we've done great things, we have new bells and whistles, love and kisses, the CrimNet task force, but we won't exactly have a detail about what was accomplished in the prior year. And I think we need a little bit more detail than that so that we can keep folks who should be on task on task.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Do you want to comment to the proposed amendment? Or
Mr. Chairman, I don't have trouble with the amendment. I don't know if the amendment is clear enough. I know I may be old-fashioned, but when I think of the word milestone, I think of one of those markers that marks out every mile that you go by. I remember from my old CB days, we used to refer to mile marker, whatever it was. So if we're looking at projects that have been completed and descriptions thereof, that's fine. I just have trouble with the word milestone because I'm not sure that I can immediately figure out what that means. Other than that, I have no trouble with the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, would objectives be? I take project milestones from the other reports that I've read, so I think the CrimNet folks would understand. But if objectives is more pleasing, I'd be glad to amend that.
Representative Smith,
I have no suggestions, Mr. Chairman.
There's no objection, Mr. Storkamp? No.
I have no suggestions.
No, I was looking at him. There's no objection from Mr. Storkamp up there up to the language. So do you want to move that amendment? Okay, so Representative is going to move an oral amendment, which the oral amendment would be after project semicolon on line 29, there would be a new number 2, and then it would say number and description of projects, a project objectives achieved during the previous year, semicolon, and then renumber the rest of the objective, the rest of the as listed there. Is that clear to everyone? Any other comment on that proposed amendment? So all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, and the amendment is passed. Any other comments or questions on the bill that's before us as amended? Representative Smith would renew his motion then that House File 2484 as amended pass and be placed in the General Register on the House floor. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, and bill is passed. Okay, our next bill, House File 2630, 2630. Representative Smith.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would move that House File 2630 be recommended to pass.
Okay, House File 2630 is before us. Why don't you proceed to present the bill, sir?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is an amendment, I believe, a DE amendment. I don't have a copy of it. Yes, I do have a copy. It's a DE2 amendment.
Okay, there's a DE2 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, it is not timely presented to the committee. It's my understanding from the looks of it, and I would ask that the committee be aware of that and waive any objection to timeliness.
Okay, so we see it was received 4:03 p.m. Does anyone have any objection, or do we need to make a motion to do this, or can we just... Is there any objection to moving ahead with the delete all amendment? Seeing none, we will just proceed with the delete all amendment. Representative Smith.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I guess I
just move the amendment.
I have an oral amendment to the DE amendment that I've also just been made aware of. It's a couple of words, and I'm looking for those. It'd be on page 2, line 32. Right. On line 32, after the word is, I would move the three words be added as follows: not frivolous and.
What page again?
Page 2. Yes. Yeah. Okay, it's line 32, page 2. After the word is, insert non-frivolous and.
Can that be incorporated in the DE?
Yeah, we'll just incorporate that into
the... Then I'd move the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape.
That's the only amendment?
That's it.
Okay. So the author incorporates that slight verbal amendment into the DE amendment and moves that we pass bring the House the DE amendment House File, House H2630DE2 before the committee. So... proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill has been brought to me in part.
Mr. Smith, I guess we have to vote on bringing that. So, all those in favor of the amendment, as Representative Olson?
I'd like to just speak against the oral amendment because I can't see how it makes any sense. If a petition is deemed to be in the interest of judgment of justice by a judge, it could not also be frivolous. So the non-frivolous statement is captured by the fact that a court, to the satisfaction of a court, the judge would have to find it is the petitions in the interest of justice. So I don't know how we advance clarity of the law by putting in not frivolous. So I would.
Okay.
I don't think we're better or worse off with the oral amendment.
Okay, Representative Ellison, what's really before us here is that was an author's amendment incorporated into the into the DE amendment.
Fair
so it's not really open for discussion. I think what we want to do is put the DE amendment before us, and then we can discuss it, and then we can go up or down on the bill depending on how we want to move ahead. So so the DE amendment is before us, E2, DE2 amendment. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay. Let's proceed, Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill has been was brought to me by the County Attorneys Association Appellate Committee. It's my understanding that the DE2 amendment that we've offered today reflects an agreement or compromise agreement between the County Attorneys Association and the public defenders. Two sides of the fence appear to be in agreement on this DE2 amendment. What it does is it amends Minnesota Statutes 590.01, which governs post-conviction remedy or post-conviction appeals. I have with me today the chief of the Minnesota County Attorneys, who's here on a regular basis, daily basis. He's around even a lot more than I choose to see him, but I'm glad he's here to help me through this. You know, in plain English, what the bill does is it establishes a two-year statute of limitations for post-conviction appeals. It's got language that I'm going to ask Mr. Kingery to briefly walk through. We'll stand ready for questions. And I think keep in mind one item when we plow through the language that I hope, in this committee's opinion, reflects my intent to protect appellants' rights to appeal, that unless I'm wrong, 1 year statute of limitations will not affect legitimate claims because the vast majority of claims, 72%, I am told, by a memo I'm looking at from the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, 72% are frivolous claims brought personally by a petitioner without the benefit of counsel. So it's, I'd ask Mr. Kingery to more fully explain this bill and what we're trying to do. Mr. Chairman?
Okay, would you state your name for the record and proceed?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Kingery, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. As Representative Smith said, this is a bill that was put together by the Association Appellate Committee. They've worked on it for over the last year and looking at the statutes from around the country and so forth, and put forth this bill with a number of exceptions to it to protect those individuals that have post-conviction appeal petitions. And it was endorsed by our board late last fall. And I know one of the things that this association has sometimes been criticized over is bringing too many issues to you. And while we may have opinions on a number of bills this session, this is only the second bill that we are supporting and advocating and pushing in this legislative session. What I'd like to do is just briefly have Daryl Hill, the assistant Ramsey County attorney and the chair of our appellate committee, briefly walk through the bill and respond to any questions that you might have.
None of them Welcome, Mr. Hill. Would you state your name for the record and proceed to explain the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Daryl Hill. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney. I am the lead attorney in the appellate unit of the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and I'm also the co-chair of the appellate committee of the County Attorneys Association. The problem that we are trying to address through this bill has been what we have seen as an increased trend in frivolous litigation brought personally by defendants without the benefit of counsel, and many of which are old, stale claims brought many, many years after they have been convicted, sometimes even brought after they've had their conviction reviewed on direct appeal. And our purpose is to try to give the courts as well as the prosecutors a fairly quick and effective and a simple tool to get these cases out of the system. Last session, for example, the state public defenders had a bill passed which allowed them to decline representation in cases involving guilty pleas or presumptive sentences. Many of these cases fall into it. And so they have done their part to try to make their roles more efficient, and this is our effort to try to also help out the system. I would like to emphasize that this bill, while it creates a two-year statute of limitations for post-conviction remedies, it does not have any effect upon a criminal defendant's direct appeal. That is the primary method by which most people appeal their convictions. Sometimes they come in under the Post-Conviction Remedy Act if it's their first bite of the apple, so to speak. If they, for whatever reason, have not filed a direct appeal. But most and the high percentage of cases are decided in terms of a direct appeal. We've also, in trying and putting this bill together, we've tried to make sure that there are exceptions so that meritorious claims can still be heard. We've created exceptions for newly discovered evidence. We've created exceptions for scientific evidence. We've created exceptions for new interpretations of statute or constitutional law so that if something happens that affects the defendant's case beyond the time of the statute of limitations, they still have a door open to get into court. I'd just like to, the need, I think, perhaps if I can briefly address it. In Ramsey County, for example, we have seen a dramatic increase in these kinds of cases. In 2003, for example, the number of cases that were filed more than doubled from what the average had been for the years of 2000, 2001, and 2002. And the vast majority, two-thirds of those cases or better, are from defendants acting without the benefit of counsel. And while it's a little, it's too early to tell, I think there is some concern on the part of the appellate committee that they will certainly maintain that pace, if not increase, because of the public defender now being able, state public defender now being able to decline representation, that the inmates are going to bring them anyway. Let me also just comment briefly on what other states have done, because as John mentioned, this has come as a result of some significant legal research with other states, and we believe that we are consistent with other jurisdictions. There's Minnesota is one of the few states, just one finger more than a handful, that do not have some kind of limitation, time limitation on the right to bring post-conviction action. In other states, they range from 60 days to 3 years. There's a wide range. The 1 year is the most common. Through conversations with Representative Smith, it's my understanding that the 2 year was submitted. I'm not sure if that's at issue at this point in time or not. The United States government and the federal system perhaps has a 1 year statute. In which for their federal habeas corpus claims, which are very similar in nature to our Post-Conviction Remedy Act. So I hope I've outlined the need, the problems we're facing, the reasons why we would like this bill passed so that we can perhaps give the courts a quick way to get rid of these petitions and spend less time on them ourselves.
Representative Ellison, have a question.
Mr. Chair, I'm not. The remarks I'm going to make are not meant to necessarily oppose your bill. I'm not sure how I'll vote on it, but there are concerns I have in it. Glad you talked to the public defender about it. But there's just some things I just would like your comment on. One is on here on page 2, line 19. This paragraph basically says that the petitioner, that in order to fit into an exception, the petitioner has to allege newly discovered evidence, including scientific evidence, and then it goes on line 19 to say that could not have been ascertained by exercise of due diligence by petitioner or petitioner's attorney. Now, this goes sort of to the heart of your critique of the present situation. You know, I would like to see the words "for petitioner's attorney not including defendant." And the reason why is because getting attorneys to do post-conviction is not easy. First of all, a lot of very experienced criminal lawyers and appellate criminal lawyers, you know, I don't think there's a big market in post-conviction cases, quite frankly. So that, you know, I think that that's one problem. The other problem is the problem of ineffective assistance of counsel. Ineffective assistance of counsel is a serious problem. You know, the law is complex. A lot of lawyers don't even know it all or don't know about the latest cases that come out or just don't have time to put into the case a lot of times. And I just think that, I'm just concerned that if a petitioner knows that he or she may have may fit into a valid exception, that's one thing. But if their lawyer knows and the lawyer and the petitioner tells them the lawyer still doesn't act, which does happen, and as you well know, I'm concerned about that. Putting someone's fortunes on what a post-conviction lawyer does or doesn't do within 2 years. So that's one thing that I'm concerned about. The other thing that concerns me is that on line 22, that basis a part of a post-conviction exception, I mean, you can't get the exception if the newly discovered evidence is for impeachment purposes. Let me just present this to you. I had a case one time where the only evidence, and this is as a post-conviction lawyer, not a trial lawyer, but I got this case on post-conviction where the only two witnesses against my client who said my client was here at a certain place at a certain time were two people who went unimpeached at trial. After we did this much digging, just a little bit, we found out these people had extensive convictions for false information to a police officer, all types of lying, all types of offenses, criminal convictions that bore directly on their credibility as witnesses. I think if the jury would have known about that, you know, they may not have been convicted in the first place. So I'm a little bit reluctant to put that clause in there about impeachment purposes. I'm a little reluctant to do that, and I wish you'd consider taking it out. Then the third thing I'm concerned about is on line 22 as well, which is the threshold for demonstrating actual innocence, clear and convincing. I don't know what it is in other states, but I'd like to see it be just the regular civil standard of preponderance of the evidence. Then on line 27, it says that if it's a new interpretation of law, either by the Minnesota Supreme Court or the United States Court of Appeals, I'd like to see included in there the Eighth Circuit, the Court of Appeals, or the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And then the thing I said about the frivolous, I just on line 32, I still think that if a court believes it's in the interest of justice to grant a motion for rehearing on a post-conviction, then by necessity it's not frivolous. Finally, let me just remark that I think what this bill would do, I don't think it's going to stop filings at all and sentence committee members. I think the filings will probably continue to just route them out of the system a little quicker, which may be a good thing. But I don't know, but, you know, you've got people in prison who don't have that much to do. They're going to just sit there and work on their deals. And what else they going to do? Play spades? I don't know if it's going to work out. You know, I think the different ways out. Maybe, I'm not sure what I think it's done about that. But I just don't know if it's going to cut down filings. If they make it easier to dispose of. But if you would be open to the remarks I made about some of the stuff in here, I can see myself supporting that.
Mr. Hill, do you want to comment to that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison. Let me take your comments here one at a time. Hopefully I will not miss anything. The definition of the newly discovered evidence, which you've alerted to in line 20 and line 22 on the impeachment purposes, or line 19, excuse me, for the petitioner's attorney, the definition was taken from existing case law so that there was an effort that we aren't going to be changing the law in that particular area. The clear and convincing standard, I'm not sure if That might be the only exception, but I know there is an actual innocence element to the newly discovered evidence. On line 27, on the relation of the courts, I think, I guess I personally have some problems with adding the Eighth Circuit because, in my experience, Minnesota courts really don't look at the Eighth Circuit all that often unless there's nothing in their system. The Court of Appeals very seldom, I can't say never, but very seldom is going to make those kind of interpretations, but that's certainly something that could be considered, could be inserted for that purpose. And in relation to the last one on line 32, the insertion of the not frivolous and, this was, as John said, was a result of some discussions between ourselves and the State Public Defender's Office. Their concern is they wanted something that was going to allow them to bring the truly meritorious claims beyond the two-year period, and perhaps ones that didn't fit neatly into the exceptions. Our concern was that we wanted a mechanism that where we could quickly get rid of the frivolous cases and not even have to talk about the merits or the interest of justice. And by including that language, that was the intent, was to provide something we were both concerned about that we both could agree on.
Representative Ellison.
Very briefly, would you mind commenting? And I'd actually be interested in hearing from the public defender, if they're not scheduled to testify, about the line 19 and, you know, requiring that, I mean, basically taking out the provision about the judicial attorney, based on the possibility of ineffective assistance. And if the petitioner has actual knowledge that there are legitimate issues that he or she could raise regarding newly discovered evidence, then the petitioner probably should do something about it within 2 years of learning about it. But if the petitioner gets counsel, and that might take 8 months to get a lawyer, they might have to raise money or whatever. And then the lawyer has to get it together. Then the attorney might be pushing it up against that 2 year limit, which is why I'd rather have the petitioner have responsibility for taking action rather than their lawyer, because who knows? You know, I've seen lawyers put things on their desk and not get back to it for a long time. And then the other thing, if you could comment on that. And then the other thing is about impeachment. I mean, would you be willing to say that if there are issues affecting the credibility of critical witnesses, like I said, I mean, all of us here speak from personal experience. I got a case on post-conviction where the only two witnesses against my client were people who were not impeached from their prior convictions at all in trial, and yet they had convictions for false information to police and a whole bunch of other stuff. So, I mean, if the trial already would have just asked about it, it could have very well have been a different outcome. In a lot of cases, the sole basis of the state's case is the credibility of their witnesses. And when they're not impeached, when they could have been, I mean, I think that's sort of a problem. And so I would prefer to see, if not for impeachment purposes, I'd like to see that. I mean, could you comment?
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, in relation to your concerns about the petitioner's attorney, I guess one of the reasons that is in there is we have seen cases, there's not a lot of them, they're the isolated example, but we have seen cases where the petitioner's attorney has sat on things for a significant period of time, even situations where they've filed a direct appeal. Without mentioning names, I've got a case now, it's a first-degree murder case that's sitting on my back table, where they filed a direct appeal. The case was stayed by the Supreme Court pending post-conviction relief, and we are now, I believe, at about the 18-month point, and the attorney has not yet filed the post-conviction relief. So I, I think there is a concern in that regard, too, that the attorney could make things stale if they're not in there. And I agree most people are not going to. But it is a small concern. Impeachment was your second one. I think that concept is so firmly embedded in the case law, in the criteria that you need for newly discovered evidence, that I would certainly hesitate recommending taking it out with all due respect to the situation that you relate. I think to put in a bill and then change the description of the newly discovered evidence, and particularly take out a criteria that's embedded by, I think I'm safe in saying, dozens of cases that says it cannot be used for impeaching purposes, I would have hesitation with all due respect in recommending that.
Thank you. We have one more question. I'd just like to point out, Representative Ellison, I think, we're looking at an amendment that didn't meet the deadline, but actually the section in the amendment that you're dealing with is exactly the same as it was in the original bill. And if there was an amendment or something that, you would have liked to have brought forward, we hopefully could have done that. But
since you say that, Mr. Chair, I feel a need to respond because you're sort of suggesting that I didn't take care of business on time.
No.
I was intending to raise this issue before the amendment ever came up.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you. Representative Johnson, Pimar, pardon me, had a question. Any passes? Okay, any other comments or questions on the bill as amended before us? Anybody from the audience that will want to comment or make a comment? If not, then Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 2630, as amended, pass and be moved to the House floor, the General Register. All those in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
Okay, the bill passes.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, committee.
Thank you. We have one final bill on the agenda for today, House File 2352. Welcome, Representative Johnson. Do you want to move your bill? And
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move it be passed and go on to the General Register, if possible.
Okay. House File 2352 is moved to pass and go to the General Register and House floor. It's before us today, so would you proceed with testimony, Representative Johnson?
Yes, Mr. Chair. What this bill does is recognize the increasing challenges and dangers that probation officers face. And simply what it does then is to make it a felony to assault a probation officer or throw bodily fluids at a PO while he or she is performing their job. Employees of correctional facilities are currently covered under this law. And again, the purpose is probation officers often find themselves in hostile situations, and this bill makes it clear that harming a probation officer is a serious matter. And there's a probation officer, Terrence Wagner, from Ramsey County, who wanted to just say a few words with respect to this increasing issue. Just for the record, if you'd say your name. And
Mr. Wagner, would you say your name and proceed with testimony?
Terrence Wagner, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm a chief steward for 300 probation officers in Ramsey County and a member of a core group of POs that represent all state and community correction workers or community corrections counties for probation officers. I'm just here to say that incidents of violence toward probation officers or those working under that job description are increasing. We're asking in harm's way. We do have incidents where people are assaulted and nothing happens, which does not reinforce behavior change for the members that we're dealing with. And I'm just here to ask that you would consider this amendment as it makes sense, and I think it's only going to get worse in the future. That's really all I have to say, unless there's questions.
Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know there is an amendment that I think is forthcoming, the A1 amendment. And
I think everybody has the A1 amendment now.
Representative Strom wants to say anything about it.
Representative Strom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Representative Johnson's bill adds the element of feces and bodily fluids for probation officers. It currently exists for correctional officers, and this would also add the same penalty for police officers, which is not in statute at this time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, before we can proceed on on an amendment, this was not received in a timely fashion as well, so we'd have to agree as a committee. There are no objections to proceeding with an amendment? Okay, seeing no objections, would you like to move the amendment?
I would like to move that amendment.
Okay, Representative Strom moves the H2352A1 amendment. Do you want to comment to it?
I consider it a friendly amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the author considers it a friendly amendment. Any other comments or questions on the amendment? Have you had a chance to look at it before? So all those in favor of the H2352A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. Any other questions on the bill or any other comment anybody wants to make from the committee? From the audience? This is too easy. Okay, then, Lippman had a question.
One other matter after a brief announcement or matter after the Johnson bill.
Okay, if there's no other comment on the bill, then Representative Johnson renews his motion for House File 2352 as amended to pass and move on to the general register on the House floor. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the motion passes. Representative Lippman has a...
just recognize me.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, we have a few minutes left, but we need to get over to the floor session. I would move reconsideration on House File 2630. Is that correct? 2339. For purposes of move to reconsider, there would be a amendment offered by Representative Lippman that we've reached agreement to as a result of discussion with that bill. So I would move reconsideration of House File 2339 at this time.
Okay, Representative Smith moves that we reconsider the vote on House File 2339. All those in favor of that motion to reconsider, would you signify by saying aye?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. That motion prevails. So House File 2339 is now before us once again.
All right, Mr. Chairman. There'll be an amendment passed around that will be do you have that?
I believe this side of the table has it, but the page is bringing it to the other side.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lippman, can I do this? As
Mr. Smith, Representative
Sure.
Smith.
Mr. Chairman, then we're passing around printed language that I would offer as an oral amendment, and I would direct the committee's attention back to the bill. Line 17, deleting the word specifies the, and then line 18, deleting purposes for which the test results may be used, and inserting instead language as follows, quote, limits uses of samples to those authorized by section 241-338, unquote. And the committee, and Mr. Chairman, that references a statute that governs, existing statute governing the use of test results for which the bloodborne pathogen test result can be used, and it specifies that it...
Mr. Chairman, actually, I made a typo. Mr. Chairman, it's line 16 and 17 rather than 17 and 18. I was writing on an angle and got my numbers wrong. So it's instead of 17 and 18, it should be 16 and 17.
It's on page 2. And the language that I read into the record refers to MS 241.338, and simply that already governs the use and controls the use of the test results in order to determine the need for treatment and the medical care specific to the related illness. Test results may not be used as evidence in any criminal proceeding, civil proceeding, except for procedures, and then it goes on to reference additional statute. Representative Lippman raised the issue. I think he's developed this wording in consultation with
The Department of Corrections representatives and the Teamsters.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, everybody understands this is page 2 of the bill. The handwriting on the bottom is the changes that are being proposed. Any other questions or comments on those proposed changes as an amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Okay, then Representative Lippman moves the amendment as we've described it here.
You moved it?
Okay, excuse me. Representative Smith moved the amendment as it's given to us here. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, that amendment is adopted. And now we're back to the bill as amended. Any other questions on the bill as amended? Okay, then all those in favor of passing House File, is it 233?
I renew my motion that House File 2339 as amended be recommended to pass.
Okay, and move to the House General Register. All those in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Mr. And Chairman, before you dismiss, two items, or maybe just one. I would like to point out that, for your information, this coming Friday is House researchers Joe Cox's last day in advising us, guiding us, helping us, allowing us to put our thumb on him and demand information here at the table, and he can produce it at the drop of a hat. Friday is his last day. He's not scheduled to be here tomorrow. And I want to publicly and before the committee thank you, Joe, for your long hours, your dedication, not only on issues that come before this committee, but you also helped on a certain child support bill that I've been working on for a few years. So, Joe, thank you.
Hail to the judge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You can adjourn at this time.
Thank you. This committee will reconvene at 5 o'clock this afternoon. Is that correct?
Recess, that's correct.
So we're going to recess now? So we're going to recess till 5 o'clock this afternoon. We will reconvene in this room. Is that right? In this room at 5 o'clock. Thank you.
I'd like to call back into order House Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee for purposes now of taking up House File 2308. Representative Zellers. And I believe Representatives Meslow and Strand will present with you. And one of, so just to proceed, one of you make the motion, and let's get on with it.
Not much better.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, I'll go with House File 2308, you recommended this pass. You referred to
Civil.
Civil law.
Representative Strand moves that House File 2308 be recommended to pass and that it be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. It's before us. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Before you right now, we have House File 2308. The bill itself increases the penalty for criminal sexual conduct in the first degree to a life in prison sentence. As we go down through the next 2, 3, and 4 level offenses, it increases the mandatory minimums. It also includes the possibility of indeterminate sentencing. The bill also provides for a review board that is currently is not in existence to be created, to be managed and staffed by not only members of the Governor's Office, Health and Human Services, Department of Corrections, but also a member at large. That review board would then review all cases coming out under first through fourth degree. Under the provisions, Mr. Chairman, members, we'll find a number of different increases in penalties, also from the mandatory minimums, the presumptives, to also then making them the mandatory minimums. There's a number of different provisions in here that we'd like to discuss. If there are any questions from the committee, I will be happy to forward them, as well as the two co-authors with me, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a couple of technical amendments.
Let's get on those right away then.
Okay.
Representative Zellers.
The first one is the 2308A10 amendment.
All right, Representative Strawn moves the A10 amendment. It's before us. Tell us what it does.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Mies. The A10 amendment strikes the or deletes the 609.3459, and it includes in line seven and eight the supervised and conditional. It's a corrective amendment, Mr. Chairman, to put the bill in order.
Okay, let's treat it as such. The Representative Strawn moves the A10 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would prefer. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. That passes. That amendment is adopted. Do you have any others?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have 2308A6. This is in relation to the data privacy. The reason we'll be going to the civil law committee on Friday. It's to make sure that we have all the materials that are.
That'd be the A9 amendment.
Yeah, I apologize, Mr. Chairman.
Let the record reflect that the motion includes the A9 amendment.
There it is. My apologies, Mr. Chairman. So that the review committee can then look at all information relating to the amendment or to the offender, both official and unofficial materials.
All right. The Representative Strawn moves the author's amendment A9. Get the bill in the shape he prefers. If there's no discussion, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. Any others?
No other author amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Then the bill, 2308 as amended, is before us. Do you have any testifiers?
Mr. Chairman, I have two of the co-authors up here, but at this point, unless I'll leave it open to either one of them if they'd like to testify at this point, I do not have any testifiers.
Okay, well, let's do this. First of all, I don't see any immediate burning questions from anyone. I think what I'll do right now is see if there's anyone in the audience wishing to be heard on House File 2308. Could you raise your hand, either pro or con? Raise your hand. I see one hand to my left, none to my right. Let's take that testimony now, then we can proceed with any other amendments. Sir, have a seat at the table, and we'll take your testimony now. And we are making an audio recording. I'll ask you to identify yourself and then proceed. If there's any questions, I'd ask you to go through the chair and be recognized if there are any questions. Sir, give us your name and then go ahead.
Okay. My name is Jim White. I live in St. Paul. I'm a private citizen. Can you hear me okay? I don't represent any group, any organization. I'm simply representing myself here. I have a couple of thoughts that I'd like to bring forth today regarding this Bill 2308. For the last 3.5 years, I've been visiting a sex offender up at Stillwater Prison. And this is through an organization here. Every week, I go up about every 3 weeks, and we talk about lots of different things. You know, think everything from the weather, the Vikings, whatever. It's just some pretty private things, like his offense, what his goals, aspirations are, what he thinks is going to happen after post-release, so forth. And the thing that really strikes me is the fact that there is the possibility for both rehabilitation and what you might call a redemption. The last time I visited him, I got to say he was probably the happiest I ever seen him. I don't know why, but I did ask him. I said, Tom, and his name really is not Tom. He did ask me to please keep his name confidential, but he has okayed me to tell me some of the things that he has told me to tell you people. I asked him, I said, are you happy? He says, yeah. Do you think you'll go to heaven when you die? Yeah. And then I asked him, I made mention, I said, you know, 15 years imprisonment, don't you think that's a long time? He said, no, I deserve it. It's my second time in. And I am deeply, deeply sorry for what I did to my victim. And I am never, ever going to re-offend again. I want to get out of here. I want to get out of here alive. And, you know, I really found that really something. I was really amazed when I heard this. I thought, you know, there is, and I realized sex offense is a heinous crime. It is has a very, very high recidivism rate. But there still is the possibility for redemption somehow, even small as it may be. Tom, we'll call him, is an offender who I think you might call your model offender or model prisoner. Goes to mass every Sunday, works in the prison upholstery shop. He goes to, I think they have Bible studies. He is working on his reading, saving money for post-release. I've even advised him against returning to his community in northern Minnesota simply because it's a small community, could have some real problems there. And I do say, bring this all to you, and one point that I do want to bring to members of the committee, it's very easy, and I realize this Drew Shadeen case is a heartbreaker. I know I have a 16-year-old daughter. If that happened to me, and I ask myself, what would I do? This is a terrible thing. But I ask that maybe you consider backing off on this bill and maybe putting it up on the shelf and maybe waiting until maybe next year. See what happens after Mr. Rodriguez is brought to trial, see what happens there. Kind of let the dust settle a little bit. When we make legislation in the what I might call knee-jerk or in the fit of emotions, things can happen. People can get hurt. And if I may, I'd just like to share one incident which kind of really motivated me to even come here today. A lady I used to work with some years ago had a son, 17 years old, started to get into trouble. And I think some of you may have remembered, I don't know the exact name or the title or the number of the bill, but it's something to do with the Minnesota Peace Officers Bill that was passed in 1996. This was after a couple of St. Paul policemen were killed in, a gang-related ambush, which basically, if you are involved in a crime which results in the death of a police officer, automatic life imprisonment, no questions asked, no parole. Well, this lady that I knew, and I met the son, Tim, and he started getting into trouble. Spring of 1997, he stole the Lincoln Continental in a high-speed chase down 35, sped off the Elko exit right into a Minnesota Highway Patrolman car, killing the patrolman. Automatic life in prison, no questions asked. Now, this young man commit a crime? You betcha. Did he deserve to be punished? You betcha. Does he deserve life in prison without parole? I don't know. I have a very difficult time. So the main thing I do want to ask you, members of the committee today, is to please reconsider this bill right now. Maybe next year, maybe a little bit later, but right now. I do think somebody's got to get hurt. Go with the sex offender, the laws that are already on the books. I think they are working. If you do want to put some money in this program, which I know is pretty tough right now with the tight budget that the state has, but the rehabilitation program. I know my friend's been waiting for at least a year to get in. I think he'd be a good candidate. But I'm not here to advocate for him in any way. But that might be where we could put our emphasis. But as I say, my main message to you, if you could please think about maybe deferring this till maybe next year. Thank you very much for your opportunity. I also might invite you, if any one of you do want to maybe meet with a sex offender, possibly my friend, I could ask him, or would like to discuss this further, I'd be more than happy to talk to you. I can give you I guess Kevin said I could give you my card. My business card has my name, phone number, both home and office phone numbers. So thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you here today. Thank you.
Before you leave, there may be questions. Is it Mr. Hoyt,
yes,
or White?
Hoyt.
White.
White.
White? Mr. White, questions from the committee at this time, Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Mr. White, could you give us a little bit more of your background so we know why you have access to prison?
Well,
Mr.
Yes,
White.
I am, as I say, can you hear me okay? Okay. Yes, I am, as I say, I represent no one. I'm simply a private citizen here. I am in a group. They did ask me not to mention the name of the group simply because they do not want to be a lobbyist. I can certainly give you that information, if I get in contact with the person. It's through a group that has allowed me to, it's kind of put me together. As I say, this group does not want to be seen as any kind of abdication or lobbyist. How I happened to get into this group was that story that I had just recounted to you about this friend of mine and what happened to him, or his, I should say, her son.
I go there, I guess, in the, maybe on a more personal level. I strongly believe in rehabilitation, and you might say, sounds a little religious, but redemption. I am a Roman Catholic. Our faith teaches us very much the importance of redemption. Not so much punishment, but you know, I don't know how else to put it. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Are you a lawyer?
No, I'm not.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And then Representative Strawn, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. White, I think the basis of your testimony seems to be that you feel that this is a whipsaw or knee-jerk reaction to the Drew Shedin case, and I guess I would challenge that supposition. I mean, I'm a police officer. I was directly involved with the Deputy Liebenstein's incident that you referred to with the kid that ran mm-hmm. into him, attended his funeral. He left a widow and three kids. Mm-hmm. As a police officer, I went through East St. Paul, through the woods, and through houses searching for the suspects after being in front of the fresh blood from the two officers that were slain by that suspect. And I don't say that to overdramatize it. I say it because I certainly know what you're talking about. I deal with suspects all the time, and they're human beings. Mm-hmm. You know, they're our kids and our brothers and sisters and our parents and our cousins. I realize that. This is not an overreaction. This is simply recognizing, I think, that sexual offenders are as dangerous as murderers. Murderers tend not to recommit that crime. It's a very personal crime, murder. Sex offenses, and we got some testimony on this in government operations just the other day, a lot of the newer research is showing that their level of victimization of other people they didn't get caught for is extraordinary. And this is a set of offenders that are, in many ways, certainly as dangerous, sometimes almost more dangerous, than people who commit homicides, and that's what we're recognizing. So I appreciate what you're saying, but I think the presumption is incorrect. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Ellison.
Mr. White, Mr. Chair, Mr. White, in the course of your, if you're working with this one offender, this one sex offender, have you come across any ideas about whether or not all sex offenders are the same? I mean, what do you distinguish between the two? I mean, for instance, criminal sexual conduct could include sex with a person who's younger, who may happen to be consensual, or it may happen to be a forced thing, or it could involve a child. Do you, in the course of your experience, have you recognized any differences between sex offenders? And if so, do you think they should be treated differently?
Yeah, it's hard to say. This is the only one, I'll have to admit, he's the only one I've ever met. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the only time I've ever been in a prison. One thing I like to say, that the thing that never ceases to amaze me as I go up there, you know, they have a visiting room probably like this, the size of about this room here. It's, you know, I look, they're just Joe Blow people, just like you and I. And it's just, I never am ceased to amazed at that. But they obviously did do some pretty horrific things, and there's reasons that they should be there, and I fully recognize that. But I guess, kind of really what I'm calling for, if we could kind of temper this a little bit, you know. Every time we call for increasing sentencing or whatever, the prisons become more overcrowded, and then we as a society have to build more prisons. Just last week we had I think we had a meeting on private prisons. Maybe there's a different way. I guess that's what I'm suggesting that maybe we look at here. Are there laws that we have on the books right now, which I understand were increased some time ago, I don't know, 10 years ago, are they doing it? I don't know. I guess I'm throwing that question out. But I can certainly understand, you know, your concerns, too.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question of the witness. I'm sorry, were you still going?
No.
All right, Representative Meslow.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. White, thank you very much. Thank you for stepping forward.
If anybody would like, I can give you my card. If anybody does want to talk to me about this or whatever, I may leave my card here.
I can actually just follow up. This is as much a follow up to the questions that have been asked as anything. I don't know that it requires a response from Mr. White, so I can proceed if that's all right.
Why don't you go ahead and let's focus on the other amendments that are here and see if we can work on the bill. But
thank
go
you.
Ahead, please respond.
Thank you. To follow up with what Representative Ellison said, we do have many different levels of criminal sexual conduct when we're talking about life in prison. Without the possibility of parole, we're talking about CrimSex 1. That's sexual penetration, and we're then focusing in on the additional factor, either where we're talking about particular safety issues, use of an accomplice, use of a weapon, or we're talking about something involving the victim, someone who's under 13 years old, someone who is incompetent or incapacitated, someone who's under 16 with a significant relationship to the defendant. So we are truly talking about the worst of the worst here, and I would just urge the committee as we look at this that as much as we want to think about redemption, our top priority is the safety of society out there. I received an email due to my involvement in the bill from someone who said he had just, that 5 years ago he got out of Stillwater after having served an extended sentence for burglary. While he was in prison and while he was in the halfway house, he had significant contact with people who had been convicted of murder, people who had been convicted of criminal sexual conduct. He said, spending years and years with these people, I'll tell you my experience is, I'll feel safe with many of those people who were convicted of murder back out on the streets because those people are getting rehabilitated. But the people who have been convicted of criminal sexual conduct at the higher levels, he said, we're not safe out there. We're not safe with those people coming out. Those are the people I lived with day after day after day. And that was the experience that he talked to me about.
All right, we're going to. There's no more testimony from anyone in the room. We're going to now go to, at this point, to any further questions from the committee of the author, and then we were going to go to amendments and then discussion of the bill. So, questions right now of the author, Representative Lippman, and Ellison, Representative Lippman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Zeller. I have a couple of quick questions. Two of them are fairly ordinary. One, I think, is impossible, but I'll give you all three. And let me first by saying, Mr. Chairman, Representative Zellers, that I commend you for taking on probably the most difficult, thorny, complicated, emotional, and important topic this session. So you're to be commended for that. But if I can turn your attention to page 31, lines 4 through 7, I guess I'm concerned about a pattern sex offender is one whose criminal sexual behavior is so ingrained, and that would be the word I'm focusing on, is so ingrained that the risk of reoffending is great without intensive psychotherapeutic intervention or other long-term controls. I think that that would be the way that we would talk about it ordinarily, but I don't know of a sexual behavior that's so ingrained. I'm not sure that that's much... That's a very good set of instructions either to a court or to officials. I'm just wondering what you think about that language.
Representative Zellers.
Sure, and thank you for the compliment, Mr. Representative, Mr. Chairman, thank you. What we're seeing in a lot of these cases, Representative Lippman, is that the recidivism rate, the mentality that goes into the commission of the crime, the once they are incarcerated and some of the treatments that they're seeing, is that these are patterns or these are thoughts, the development that has been going on for a lifetime. In certain cases, it will never be able to be cured, either with treatment, psychopathic or otherwise. So when we say, you know, the word ingrained, you're correct, is because it is something that has been either under the surface or has not been... Not been, I don't want to say caught, but has not been realized either in a criminal method or either in a therapeutic method prior. One of the studies that just came out last December shows that for every one of these times we catch them, there's 10 other instances where they've done this before. So I think that not only does the data, but the numbers show that in the past these folks have done this before, will continue to do this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zellers, I'm going to try to think of better words between now and civil law. So I'll just put you on notice. If I could turn your attention to page 40, lines 27 through 29. My question is, mindful that the inmate may petition the board, under these circumstances that you describe in the bill, I guess, not the 24-month situation, I'm just wondering whether under subsection C there's any limit on the number of petitions that particular inmate can submit, because it could seem that particularly with inmates who might not have other things to do, they could forward a lot of petitions, be denied forward a lot of petitions, and oblige the board to use a lot of resources revisiting quickly the questions that have already been decided. At least that's my concern.
Before you respond, I want to hear from Ms. Zollers with reference to some of the statements of questioning, if you could.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Lippman, the language that you were referring to on page 31, that's in section 23, is current law that exists right now in section 609-108 of the Minnesota statutes. There are two sections of law that are being moved and amended in as part of this bill. They're sections 23 and 24, which were section 609-108 and 609-109.
Then I'll withdraw my earlier notice. If we've been laboring under ingrained, I guess it's okay to continue how we got along there. But perhaps if I could raise the question about to page 40, will there be serial petitions to the board, or is there a way to stop that that kind of practice?
I'm going to defer to one of the other co-authors, okay. Representative Meslow.
Representative Meslow. Mr. Chair, Representative Lippman, that section, or that subparagraph, is set up not to allow for random petitions, but there's a threshold. The board has to first authorize that petition would apply. So it's when the board would, say there is a valid basis for filing a petition faster than that 24-month timetable. Now we're ready to hear that. But unless there's specific authorization or authority from the board, then that's not going to happen.
By the board's leave.
It would be by the board's leave if, for example, there were some new interpretation of a rule that the board had applied for and they said, gosh, we denied somebody the opportunity a year and a half ago rather than waiting out the rest of those 24 months. This would seem to apply to this inmate's situation. Let's go ahead and hear him. And so it's really giving the board that flexibility and latitude.
Representative Lippman.
Okay, finally, the impossible question, Mr. Chairman, Representative Meslow and Strand and Zellers. I'm concerned about, if you have the fiscal note, page 19 out of 20, in that the Public Defender Service, among others, suggests that if your bill is passed, and I do like your bill a lot, that plea agreements for criminal sex one cases will be a thing of the past, which is I'm going to get life imprisonment, says the inmate, or indeterminate sentence, you know, for life, might as well roll the dice, and that we have an additional 111 trials per year, which is a huge resource use and allocation. Representative Ellison and Representative Meslow and I tomorrow will present the solution to the bed impact problem. You know, we can solve that. We've got a great idea for that. But the trial problem, I don't have an answer to, and I'm just wondering whether you have any insight. I mean, that seems like a massive commitment of resources, and perhaps we should do it, but it gives me pause.
Response, Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lippman, obviously this is a fiscal note that just came out today, so we need to spend a little more time going through that and taking a look at it. I would submit that just on first glance, that number struck me as surprisingly high. That is a higher number than I would expect to see. Certainly there is still the opportunity for negotiation between first and second degree criminal sexual conduct, which again gives us the opportunity for the indeterminate sentencing. I would think a number that would be an issue that a prosecutor could consider by way of negotiation. And in that sense, we haven't taken away tools. We've added to the tools. I'm not convinced that this will give us substantially more trials. It may give us some, but I'd be surprised if the number was that high. I'd like to spend a little more time looking at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, you've been great and generous.
Very good. Representative Ellison?
Mr. Chair, just to have a procedural question, because we just got, Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry, I was distracted. Representative Ellison.
I was just going to ask the Chair, since we got our fiscal note today, is this our last shot at this bill, or are we going to see it again regarding the financial questions, or could maybe...
Representative Ellison, no, I announced at the beginning, and I'll repeat, no, our intent and what we're going to do tonight, hopefully, is pass the bill, and then we refer it to civil law with the understanding that it'll be coming back here after civil law, in part that we can deal with the fiscal note at that time. So we can talk about it tonight, but we're not going to waste any time doing so because we have these policy amendments, etc. That will also have a fiscal impact, probably. So it is coming back here is the quick answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy on that?
Mr. Chair, we'll still be able to talk about policy as well as the fiscal.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Let me just, rather than ask questions, I'm just going to share some fears about this bill with you, and maybe you could respond. And Representative Meslow, I understand that the mandatory life is for the first degree offenders, and that's an issue that, you know, might be a good thing or might be bad depending on perspective. But I guess one of my big concerns is just, you know, remembering that, you know, I've represented any number of people, 19, 20 years old, have sex with their 15-year-old girlfriend. Mom finds out about it, and they want to press charges. I think that credible arguments can be made that, however consensual, it's abusive. I think credible arguments can be made in that direction. But, you know, that person would be subjected to indeterminate sentencing. And if so, I've made the statement last hearing, and we'll repeat it. I can't see how anybody on the review committee would see it in their political interest to let anybody out, because if that person gets out and does something else wrong, they're gonna be in the press. They're not gonna look good. So there is an incentive to hold people as long as you can, and we could be holding some people who I don't think any of us think deserves a life or near life sentence, given that indeterminate sentencing is just that, indeterminate. Any response to that,
Representative Messel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, we really tried to work as we created the board that would review these to take people who would be able to be sure we were including people who would be independent, that we would have a therapist who specifically didn't have ties to the government and to prosecution, that we would take a judge who was retired, so that we didn't, for example, staff the committee, the board, with police officers and prosecutors who, while serving admirable functions, might find it more difficult to be independent. It's our intention that this would be a board that would be able to take a fair look at individual situations, review those, and make appropriate decisions. Indeterminate sentencing is just that. People should be able to get out when they're ready to get out.
And Mr. Chair, if you would comment on, as my understanding of the bill is, if a person is a presumptive probation, then they would not be subject to indeterminate sentencing. Is that, do I have a correct understanding of the bill in that regard?
Representative Messel.
As I understand your question, yes, that would be correct.
Right. And Mr. Chair.
Representative Allen.
I mean, you do have, and so you could have, what about the case where, you know, you got the boyfriend 36 months older than the girlfriend, girlfriend's a minor, however much we would disapprove as parents of a situation like that, you know, it does happen, that person's going to be indeterminate sentencing, even if they're first-time offender. I mean, doesn't that give you some pause?
Representative Strachan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, two quick comments. In discussing this bill when it was first being formulated, for example, just to go back to your first point, the Sex Offender Review Board, talking about release, in the first draft included a law enforcement representative, and in fact, I was the one who brought up the fact that because of their connection with victims, that might not be the right person to be there, and I think the retired judge was what came out of that conversation for that very reason. I think you make an excellent point, and I think we've worked very hard on that. And number two, talking about statutory rape, which is not a term of art in our statutes, but it's what is commonly referred to as statutory rape, where the age difference is the issue, is not dealing with that is not the goal of this bill. And if you feel that there is a scenario like you discussed, where that person could fall into this what this bill is aiming at, then we I'd be very open to that amendment, because that's not what we want to aim for here. We want the worst of the worst, and statutory rape, while very, very severe, is not the goal of this bill.
Any further questions, Representative Ellison?
I would, Mr. Chairman, I just had one comment on that as well. Again, the review board is going to be there to review each one of these cases again, and as both Representative Meslow and Strand have spoke to, we are going to have a great deal of faith in that. And each of the partners, individual partners who are going to be putting those board members on there, are also going to have a vested interest. And I believe that those, the members in particular, are going to be fair and impartial as well. I mean, we like you probably heard here, we've worked very hard on that part of it, and we're going to, I mean, I do have a lot of faith in those board members.
Representative Ellison.
Just want to take a slightly different turn. In the interest of time, I don't want to drag it out, so I'm just going to lay my cards out there, and I'm going to ask you gentlemen to respond as you care to. Representative Strand, I see this thing a little bit differently in terms of when it cropped up than you do. I mean, I believe that you and other representatives who are sponsoring the bill may have seen this as an ongoing problem before the Drew Shedeen situation. But I doubt seriously any of us can argue that incident really did draw this matter to public attention in a way that before it really was not in front of the public attention. I think that incident did. I mean, oftentimes incidents do provoke legislation, as everybody around the table knows very well. But I just want to note that I'm not sure we need a change in law, and here's why. Because what we saw no more than about 3 weeks ago is a steady stair step downward of civil commitments referrals. And when you look at a guy like Rodriguez, assuming that he's guilty, and he may not be, but, you know, he's been, probable cause has been found, and, you know, I mean, this is a man with 3 violent sexual assaults. I mean, he's a truly scary person. He was in prison for 20 years. He refused chemical or sex offender treatment while locked up. He never spent more than 12 months without being in prison for some sex offense. Why wasn't this guy, if this guy would have been civilly committed as he should have been, I have my own doubts about whether we'd be here, and I have my own doubts about whether we'd be staring this fiscal note in the face. Does anybody care to remark on that? I mean, I know it's sort of a speech, but what do you think?
Representative Strand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Ellison. I guess I would just point out the fact that Representative Neville and myself had a bill that sort of comprehensively dealt with this particular issue last year before any of this came up, and so it's been on the burner. I would accept the fact that the Drew Shedeen case probably took it from the back burner to the front burner. It made it more timely. The civil commitment process, no matter which perspective you're coming from, has a lot of problems. It has constitutionality problems, expense problems, and certainly simply results problems in the sense that when people don't accept treatment at a high cost to the state because of their civil commitment status, it is shot through with problems, and there's no way to get around that. And really what this bill does simply emphasizes the fact that the legislature in the state are going from a focus on the offender and the success of rehabilitation to a focus on public safety first and foremost. And the rest of it is details, frankly.
Last question, Mr. Chair,
if you indulge us.
Okay, I'll go along with that, but one more problem we still have. We don't get away from civil commitment because we have an ex post facto provision in our Constitution, which means that your law can't apply to people who already did this. So we still are dealing with civil commitment. I mean, we're fixing this problem by coming up with this solution, but this problem is still right because we still got the problem. I mean, wouldn't be better served by focusing on how to fix that civil commitment situation. Any thoughts or reflections on that?
Sure.
Representative Zellers.
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Ellison, and that is one of the reasons why why in talking with Representative Strand about this as well, is at some point the judicial branch has led us to believe that they're going to rule civil commitments unconstitutional, or they're leaning that way, and that if we're using a basically a process that's available for mental defect or some sort of mental condition, for our excuse me, for our criminal penalties, that sooner or later, if we keep doing this over and over and over again, that it will become unconstitutional. And then that's first point. Second point is there is an end in sight with that process if this bill's passed. Any future offenders, first-degree criminal sexual conduct, would not then be in the civil commitment process. They'd be in jail. That group then, there is a defined end point to that group. Once the current system, those that are currently in the system, there's an end point.
Representative Johnson, and then Lesh, and then we're going to the amendments. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zellers, this bill does contain some real significant sentencing provision increases. I'm really curious as to how does this compare with other states nationally? Is it in the middle, or is it significantly increased sentences relative to other states, or is it less than? Where does it sit in that regard?
Representative Zellers.
I would refer to Judy as far as some of the specifics. Anecdotally, I would say that in talking with some folks around the country that have been doing this, I know Hawaii, the state of Washington, the state of Montana are looking at this. Some of our neighbors over in North Dakota are looking at increasing penalties as well. So I don't think that we're exclusive. We have led the way in some of the past work, especially by Representative Murphy on some of these issues, where we have led the way in dealing with some of our sexual offenders, dealing with some of the treatments. In this case, I think we're going with a growing movement, is what I would say anecdotally. I would defer to Judy to some of the maybe specifics.
Ms. Zellers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, many states do already have life sentences. In fact, Minnesota is in the minority in not having a life sentence. It's over half that do have a life sentence. Some have mandatory life sentences.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Okay, Representative Lesh.
Just two comments, Mr. Chair, and that I felt the need to respond to as well as a co-author of this bill. First, it was suggested that whether there's a need for a change in law, and two reasons that spring to my mind immediately. First, are just the idea that we do not have a pattern sex offender law based on recent court decisions. That's a severe problem. It needs to be addressed. It's addressed in this legislation. Number two, the current sentencing guidelines are absolutely inadequate. While it's true that maybe Alfonso Rodriguez would not have been dealt with, or we could not deal with him under this law due to what was brought up, the constitutional prohibition against ex post facto laws, it is inadequate when we have an individual who commits a crime, first-degree criminal sexual conduct, who's 18 years old, and even if he serves the maximum amount of his time, we cannot supervise him whatsoever after he's 48 years old, because that's the maximum amount of time we have in our sentences right now. And I can tell you, if I found out a sex offender moved in next door to me who committed an egregious sex offense when he was 18, was in jail for all of 30 years and moved in next door to me, but he's 48, and the state said, I'm sorry, he served his debt to society, that wouldn't make me feel any better. And I think the increase of the sentences, which may be arguable about how high we go, there's no question, it needs to be far higher than it currently is. So I just wanted to make that comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're going to go very much. We're going to go to the amendments, which there are at least two in the packet. Representative Billstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And let me just say this. I want to give you a full opportunity to present those, discuss those, and we are going to be headed towards discussion and voting on this towards the bottom of the hour. So keep that in mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, one amendment, I'll be completely brief, and
then
the second amendment, there are a few people that would like to speak to it, if that would be all right as well. I'll start with the H2308A7 amendment.
Representative Hilstrom moves the A7 amendment. It's before us. Tell us about it, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment would require the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to actually find the Level 3 sex offenders that are listed on their website as noncompliant. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is the coordinating body for this, for tracking these offenders, and they also do have the Fugitive Task Force. These people are guilty of a felony by not registering as sex offenders, and I believe that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension should be directed to go out and find these offenders.
Okay. Did you say you had testimony on this or not?
This is one I do not.
Good. I'm not. Sorry. I mean, that's fine. Representative excuse me. Representative Messel or Strawn. Comments?
Mr. Chair, we appreciate the amendment, and I guess my one comment, if I could offer an oral amendment to the amendment, if Representative Hillstrom would accept it, is that the BCA, because of the structure of the BCA, although they're sort of clearinghouse for this information, their field agents are relatively limited, and the people that are probably best equipped and most knowledgeable and best able to investigate this would be local law enforcement. So in that spirit, and also to keep the fiscal note down and make sure that we're keeping this authority with those who I think are best able to conduct it, I would, on this would be page 3 of the amendment, line 4, strike, beginning with the word conduct, and then line 5, investigation to determine the person's location, and then replace that with, after the word immediately in line 4, insert notify the local law enforcement authority to investigate. And I think that would get us to the same spirit and more effectively with what I think is a good idea. Representative Hillstrom, we could accept that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that is one of the things that we have done with sex offenders in this state is actually pass the burden of doing this job onto our local law enforcement and onto our local counties. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is the coordinating body. They have the ability to coordinate with other states better than our local law enforcement for people who have left the state. And they also have the ability to contact international law enforcement agencies for people who we believe have left the country. This doesn't mean they have to go out and fly to find someone, but I believe that they are actually in the best position to conduct the state-by-state contacts as well as the federal contacts. And so while I appreciate your willingness to work with me on this, I really think that the BCA should be the one coordinating how we find these people, and they should be working with our local law enforcement as well as other states and international governments.
Representative Strawn.
Mr. Chair, good point, Representative Hillstrom. So if I can amend the amendment to the amendment, let me, after line 4, immediately insert investigate and I think that covers both angles.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could just repeat from the beginning, then what it would say.
So, Representative Strawn, read lines 4 and 5 as you would have them amended, please.
As this would be finished. I'll start at line 3, at the end of line 3. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension shall immediately investigate and notify the local law enforcement authority to investigate and to ensure compliance with this section.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would accept that.
And with those, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
With those changes, I think this is a friendly amendment.
All right, then the record without objection should reflect Representative Hillstrom accepts that change as incorporated into her amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Anything further on this amendment as amended? Anything further on the amendment? On the A7 amendment, any further discussion? If not on the amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. It is adopted. Anything else?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have the H2308A6 amendment, and there are a few people here, I believe, that would like to testify on behalf of this amendment.
Okay, before you do that, we passed out the an additional, or I should say a new copy of the bill. You'll see it says first engrossment at the top. We just want to make sure that we're dealing with what we need to pass on next. On the A6 amendment, if you have testimony, let's take it. How many testifiers do you have?
Mr. Chair, I believe there's someone here from the counties. Is there anyone else? Yes, someone here from the counties.
So we have two testifiers?
I believe that's true.
Let's someone go first.
Mr. Chair, if I actually could explain it first and then let them speak to it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Between December 12th and the end of the year, 236 level 3 sex offender letters went out to our local counties stating that there were level 3 sex offenders that had been released or were about to be released that had not been reviewed for civil commitment. It does say in state statutes, section 244.05, subdivision 7A, that before the commissioner releases from prison any inmate convicted under section 609.342 and 609.345 or sentenced as a pattern sex offender under this section, 609.108, and determined by the commissioner to be in the high-risk category, the commissioner shall make a preliminary determination whether, in the commissioner's opinion, a petition under section 253B.185 may be appropriate. That basically says that the commissioner shall review for civil commitment people who meet these standards. Currently, the 236 level 3 sex offenders that were sent out to the county, the fiscal expense for review, approximately $2,500 per offender, and approximately $13,000 per month per offender that is chosen to be housed while being considered for civil commitment, has been passed on to the counties. That is of great concern, and this amendment would say that the state shall pay the bill.
Okay, let's take testimony. First of all, yes, testimony. We've got two testifiers. You're one. I have to limit your testimony and questions of each testifier to about 5 minutes. Let's keep that in mind. Before we go to you, Mr. Tuma, do we have any reaction on this amendment from the authors? Do you accept it? Do you not? Any comment whatsoever at this time? Please give it to us.
Mr. Chairman, members, at this time, no, I would not accept it as a friendly amendment. Any questions after the discussion of the testifiers, we'd be happy to answer.
Okay, let's get to the testimony. Give us your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is John Tuma. I'm here on behalf of the Metropolitan Intercounty Association. I'm commonly known as MICA. We represent kind of the mid-sized counties or your growth counties, Dakota, Stearns, those kind of counties like that, Anoka. And we would like to speak in favor of this amendment. Actually, this amendment came out of some discussions out of Anoka County, some of the problems they were potentially facing with the cost of placing even just one of these individuals that are now coming out without a year's notice. Typically, the year's notice gives a county attorney the time to prepare and also the county to prepare to civilly commit these persons before they're let out. Example of a case that happened to one of our counties was that they found out that a level 3 was coming out only a few weeks before that individual was to be released. They found out only because he was a level 3 and the sheriff was notified that they would have to do a community notification on this individual. Our county attorney was familiar with the case in that particular case and knew that this individual should, in his opinion, be civilly committed. And he only had a few weeks to get a petition together thanks to the Attorney General's office. They were able to get a petition and serve him only a day before he was to be walked out and let free. He is now sitting at St. Peter at some I think $360 a day coming out of the county taxpayers' rolls because there wasn't given a notice that this individual should be civilly committed, and it's the opinion of the county attorney that he will be civilly committed. Of course, it helps now that this is after the Jushadin case. But what we're going to face here is an estimated 236 of these individuals are referred to counties. The state of Minnesota, through the governor's office, is estimating that about 59 of these individuals will be civilly committed. During that pre-commitment phase, when the person is on the hold, the county has to pay 100% of that cost. After the commitment, they have to pay only 10% of the cost. These are costs that weren't planned on, and really the state should participate. If we're going to be partners in this whole civil commitment effort, and the county attorneys have to do this, we should be a partner in this bubble of individuals that are going to come through. This will probably not be a problem in the future because I think DOC has got the message and they're going to probably be more than likely willing to make sure that the referrals are done and appropriate in a timely fashion to county attorneys. But right now we are faced with a huge problem. A small county having to just deal with one of these, it could cost $100,000 to house those individuals over that time if it takes a full year. That's a significant cost for a small county's budget. And Minnesota, as the state of Minnesota, caused this problem. They should be participating in solving it. And so we're only asking for reasonable treatment, and I think this is the Hillstrom Amendment does that, members, and I stand for questions.
Any questions? All right, thank you. Your next testifier.
Mr. Chair, I don't have anyone else unless there's someone that would like to speak against it.
Okay. Anyone in the audience wanting to be heard on this amendment, step forward now. We're having somebody come, it looks like.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while we're waiting for the testifier, I would request a roll call vote on this amendment.
So noted. Sir, give us your name and proceed.
Yes. Harley Nelson, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. When the commissioner made the decision to refer the 236, and that decision was made for the safety of the citizens of Minnesota and so forth, those did go out at a time that some of those 236 were already released. Some of those 236 were soon to be released. Every effort was made to provide the counties with as much detailed information as possible at that time. This amendment, as I read it, starts to talk about the need for a psychological review. And while I was new to this department, I went back and looked at the process over a number of years. And there's a variety that had been refined over the years, and that referral became more and more sophisticated. But there was no requirement, to my knowledge, that a psychological had to be done. It is our intent to do those psychologicals. Those psychologicals consist of an interview of the offender, assessing prior psychological material. But it isn't the point that psychological is going to be effective and a reason that the county attorneys can move forward on a petition for a civil commit. It's been my understanding that they've always had to require some additional psychologicals before they would move on that case. The psychologicals that we do in the Department of Corrections are labeled in a psychological impression that isn't all the diagnostic testing and so forth that would be required to move ahead. I mentioned that it is our goal to get those out earlier. Some things that do happen, though, with the new policy of level threes is that we could have a violator come back on a technical violation. His time left on his sentence when we would have to release him would be less than 12 months. If we classify that person as a level three, it is our position right now to refer that to the county attorney, which would put us under that 12-month window. The other thing I should say that some of those 236 had been referred to the county attorneys already, so they were a second referral. So those county attorneys and the attorney general on some of those cases, and don't know which the numbers right now, but on some of those cases, this was a second referral. In this situation, when we do a second referral on that, I guess the department would not have the money, and I don't know where this money would be coming from. It's not in our budget. There may be some other places where this money could come from. But we would not have the money to be able to provide this as this amendment requires.
Sorry, Representative Hillstrom. Sorry, excuse me. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to one part of the testimony. On page 2, line 8, it does take into consideration a person who is leaving incarceration with less than 12 months. That just simply states that if the commissioner did not notify the county attorney of the county where the person was convicted prior to the person's release date, which then would take care of those people who came back in on an offense and then were released and there wasn't 1 year.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative
Nelson. That 12-month window would be very narrow. We would probably have a little bit of a turnaround so that we would be looking to refer it to them before 12 months. We would probably have to have that person returning to the prison at about 14 months so that we'd have 2 months to turn that around and get that referral out, because we would have to assess some of the things that were happening. So we would kind of, if somebody came back at 12 months in 1 day, there's no way we'd be able to meet that 12-month requirement. In those cases, we would have to pay for it. So that if this were to pass, I guess I would request that there be a little bigger window there where we can have an opportunity to get that out within the 12-month period.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The intent of this amendment is to get to these 236 offenders. That is the goal. The goal is not necessarily to get to those from here on in. We want to make sure that, of course, the department is doing these and giving the county attorneys timely notification to make sure that the county is not stuck with the bill. However, the 236 really are at issue here. And who should foot the bill? And should a level 3 sex offender who happens to be from a small county not be considered for civil commitment because the budget is driving the decision rather than how sick this individual is? So that's all, Mr. Chair.
Pardon?
I said that's all, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Any further discussion? Representative Kilstrom, I think what we're going to do, or what I'm going to do, is your amendment has merit, and it is moving, in my opinion, in the right direction. In light of the fact this bill is coming back to this committee for both policy but also fiscal attention, because this is going to have to be looked at, and in light also of the fact, frankly, the budget, the governor's budget, supplemental budget is not clear. It's my understanding that there may indeed be some money, even despite the testimony I've heard on this specific set of issues. So what I'm going to do tonight is, you have requested a roll call. I'm going to lay your amendment over for when we take this bill up again when it comes back to us. So it'll be we'll deal with it at that time. Do you have any other amendments this evening? I thought you said no. I just want to clarify that.
Mr. Chair, I do not.
Okay.
Did someone else?
Then what? If there are no other amendments, what we're going to do? Representative Lesh? Okay. Well, Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, members, this is an amendment that was
offered. Which one?
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, this is Amendment H-2308-A-8.
Very good. Representative Flesh moves the A-8 amendment. Tell us what it does.
This is a bill of mine that I had dropped in the hopper earlier this year, but was offered as an amendment in GovOps yesterday by Representative Kahn, who was also very interested and motivated on this issue. Members, the bill that we have up before us right now is a pretty big deal. As I stated before, I think it's very important that it gets passed, and also that it addresses some critical needs we have in the area of criminal justice with respect to sex offenders. That said, it has some far-reaching consequences, especially with respect to first-degree criminal sexual conduct defendants and people who are convicted of that or plea to that. This bill essentially directs law enforcement authorities and appropriate governmental entities to retain items of physical evidence that contain biological material. As folks on this committee are probably very well aware, recently there has been a lot of publicity surrounding death penalty and other cases, and that which doesn't necessarily involve death penalty, about people who were exonerated from crimes, times they spent on death row in prison, someone else came forward, and they were exonerated based on biological evidence. Folks are probably also aware that those crimes which include biological evidence constitute a very small portion of the total crimes that go through the court system. However, I'm sure we all agree that it's a travesty anytime an innocent person is convicted. And to keep that door open, ensuring that we've retained this physical evidence, I think is very important. So this amendment would direct appropriate governmental entities, as I've stated, to keep that DNA evidence until such time as we're done dealing with the person in the system, whether they're done with their time on in prison, supervised release, or however long they have to register as a sex offender. And I would entertain questions or comments on that at this point, Mr. Chair.
Any input from the committee or discussion from the committee? Let's hear from the author, Representative Strawn. What's your position? What is the author's position on this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Lesh, we discussed this in government ops extensively with Representative Kahn, who at that point in that committee offered the amendment. My concern, Mr. Chairman and members, is the burden that we would be inflicting on the local governments, especially in greater Minnesota, where the additional cost for facilities, maybe it's refrigeration, maybe it's humidifiers, whatever it may be, to keep these biological materials in check would be exorbitant, especially when we're talking about, in some cases, it may be a 10-year sentence, 20, 30 years of, or 20 or 30-year sentence, and then the probation period after that. That we check with those folks first, especially the county sheriff's office as well, before we know. And again, it's the fiscal impact. As we've found out today, we've got a pretty sizable note on this. I wouldn't want to add additional cost to the bill.
So the author is suggesting a no vote on this amendment. Is that what I'm hearing? All right. Representative Lash?
Mr. Chair, members, I just want to respond. I understand there was some concern about what other costs this may add. My understanding is that, and Representative Kahn mentioned this in committee yesterday too, is that DNA evidence does not need to be refrigerated. It could be stored independently. And the way that I understand this is it's quite as simple as you put this in, you got a closet in the police station somewhere. Fundamentally, it should not add that much cost. If I am proven wrong, or if there was someone here with information to the other to the contrary, I would absolutely be open to listening to that. But my understanding is that, especially in rural areas, small towns, for example, not only is this a small percentage of cases that include DNA evidence statewide, but it's a small percentage in any jurisdiction. So I would not think this would be a terrible burden. And I think that the potential benefits, the security, and knowing what we're doing with this bill would be well worth it.
Representative Fuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesh, I find myself in an interesting position here because I'm not an attorney. But I also, you know, I would like to play one on television. I haven't got that job yet. But
we still
have
anyway, Representative.
You made some comments, yeah, Representative Lesh, about, you know, sticking DNA evidence in a closet. And I got to have a feeling that our local units of government are going to have to keep some kind of a chain of evidence going. And your comments about just sticking it in a closet, I don't think would meet up to the court's approval. So in my mind, whether it be refrigeration or whatnot, we are still, local units of government would have to, under this amendment, have to come up with places secured. Which I suppose county jails and sheriff's offices, you know, already do have some of that. But to the comment of just sticking it in a closet, I don't think would meet the criteria.
Further discussion, Representative. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I don't think, Representative Lesh, I don't think you meant anything callous like, you know, we're backwoods and we stick things in a closet. A lot of small departments don't have an evidence room that is much more than a closet. But, Representative Lesh, with this bill coming back here, I would be more comfortable if we could have somebody from maybe the Sheriff's Association and somebody from the BCA to maybe come and talk to us a little bit about this, see what they think of it. Would you be okay with us not hearing this till this bill comes back? What they think of it? Would you be okay with us not hearing this till this bill comes back? Would you be amenable to that, or?
Representative Lash.
I guess, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I would be amenable to that if we're able to bring it up again. Yes, I would.
Okay, we still have Representative Murphy indicated a desire to talk. After hearing that, Representative Murphy.
I do, Mr. Chair. I was going to suggest that maybe somebody from the BCA would, when we toured the BCA, there was lots of storage space and there was lots of filing cabinets and there were lots of things that these people have already been so they could seem to me that evidence could be passed on to BCA and they could see because they have plenty of and maybe we should explore that between now and the next thing.
At Representatives Lesh, I'll tell you what, let's lay that amendment over. We've already done that to another one that has some costs this May as well. So the chair is going to do that, and let's proceed then back to the bill 2308 as amended. Discussion and committee, let's try to focus. Let's get our comments out. We don't need to talk this bill to death tonight. Let's try to do it within the next 10 minutes, but everyone can have a chance, and then we'll try to conclude as soon as possible and take a vote and then see where we're at that point. Again, it is going to civil law, and then it will come back here. Discussion. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sellers, and Ms. Holmes, friend who's advocating that this bill doesn't have anything in it that would make somebody feel guilty. Would you respond to that?
Representative Mezel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. I would say there's not a lot of incentive to plead guilty to criminal sexual conduct in the first degree. I think there is substantial incentive to plead guilty to criminal sexual conduct in the second, third, or fourth degree, because with the indeterminate sentencing, part of what the review board is going to be looking at is the acknowledgement and awareness of the inmate's culpability in the conduct. And I would think that there would be a substantial incentive to plead guilty to 2, 3, and 4. I would agree with you that there wouldn't be a lot of incentive to plead guilty to first degree.
Representative Murphy.
And then, Mr. Chair, representatives, what is in this bill that would stop someone from... A perpetrator from just committing the sexual act like rape rather than going ahead and then killing their victim?
Representative Zeller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, that's a question that we've asked, we've discussed several times. It's a question I've asked myself, and it's a question that we'll probably discuss time and again. And I keep coming back to the same answer. If we knew exactly what these folks were thinking when they are committing some of these crimes or when they're in the commission of the crime or leading up to it, I don't know that we need to have some of the laws we do on the books. I wish I could understand so that we could prevent or we could premeditate an action to stop this. In a lot of these cases, we can't. I mean, there is a lot of anecdotal studies. There's a lot of very scientific and psychological studies in the pathology of the thinking of some of these folks, but in some cases we can't predict. Again, as Representative Meslow has said, there isn't a lot of incentive under first degree, but there is incentive and there is safety in the general public, and I believe in my heart that's one of the reasons why I brought forward this bill, that we do need to, as public servants, our first and foremost job is public safety. And that's the real reason that there was a case just last night in St. Paul that was on the news that, you know, was terribly tragic, and reinforced again in me that, you know, in some of these cases, we just need to put them in jail.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zeller, so many of the bills that we pass them with the idea that they're going to stop because the end result is so terrible that is going to make somebody stop and think. But this bill doesn't do that. So we're just looking, by passing this bill, we're just looking, not just looking, but we're, our primary motive then is to protect the public safety. And lock up the perpetrator for as long as possible. It seems to me what Representative Lesch said is so much needs to be included in here too, and that is the intensive supervision at the end of the lockup period, 40 years or 30 years or whatever it may be. And I don't see that we have addressed that extensively enough.
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, stay tuned. We'll be hearing a bill that I've authored that will address some of those issues, some of those concerns, I believe, and will, in the end, fit pretty hand in glove with this bill.
I'll stay tuned, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? All right. Representative Zellers renews his motion. Excuse me, Strand renews his motion on House File 2308 as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Seeing no further discussion, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails and the bill is passed. All right, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. No further business this evening. This meeting is adjourned.